We are back on the Annie Jennings PR Pro interview series with our pro for the day, Lou Krieger, author of numerous books on poker, and you can certainly visit his site for lots more information. I'll give you his website, and then, Lou, you can let all of our fans and wonderful listeners know how to get lots more information. You can check out www.loukrieger.com. And, Lou, tell us a little bit about what we can find on your blog and where we can find it.
Well, you can find the blog in a couple of places. You can connect to it from the website, or you can go to http://loukrieger.blogspot.com, or just Google Lou Krieger blog, and it'll probably take you right there. I comment on anything and everything on the blog. I've been spending a lot of time talking about the politics of online poker and the various legislation that's been passed in the past couple of months, and some of the idiocy behind some of the laws, and everything from that to occasionally talking about poker hands. So whatever comes into my mind goes unfiltered right onto the blog.
Well, that sounds wonderful. And now with this, our Poker Pro podcast series, we can actually listen to you. And so many people are downloading, you know, our podcasts, and they're listening to them as they're going about their day, exercising, walking. They're just learning a tremendous amount from you, Lou, and we really appreciate you being here with us. Also, you're the author of a lot of books. Is there 11 books in your?
There are 11 books. Mm-hmm. It's been a real interesting genesis to go from the first book that I wrote, called Hold'em Excellence from Beginner to Winner, in 1995, to my 11th that's coming out this June, called 52 Great Poker Tips.
When I
wrote that first book, you know, I had always had the idea in my mind, wouldn't it be nice to write a book to be able to say, hey, I'm an author, and point to that book. And within the period of time from then till now, you had the poker boom exploding in 2003, and poker on television, and every publisher in the world, I'm not saying this to brag, but publisher after publisher was looking for books on poker, and, you know, I felt like everybody else that this incredible peaked focused interest in poker couldn't last forever, and I might as well take their money and write books while there's still an interest in doing it. Who knows what tomorrow is going to bring? So I wound up in 2006 writing 4 books, which is a little bit too much for anybody.
And the audience is only going to increase, because look at the sponsorships. I mean, they're getting bigger and bigger. Budweiser, all the beer companies, Men's Health. These are the people who are putting some money into sponsoring some of these events, or some are sponsoring the commercial time on the replays of the events. So this is a big growing opportunity for people to really capitalize, for major companies to capitalize on this.
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you looked around 10 years ago and you said, you know, in a couple of years, poker players are going to be like rock stars, people would have thought
that
you were insane.
Daniel the rock star. The grow. I just love him, though. Isn't he the cutest thing?
Daniel is a rock star. And,
yes.
And, you know, who would have thought that? A couple of years ago,
who'd
he was just
another... That? And Ferguson,
player.
I mean, my God, what a look he's got. You're right, they're stars, but they need to be packaged now. I'm going to have to package them now for them. We're a PR company by day, right? Poker player by night.
I think they are packaged. I mean, Ferguson, in essence, packages himself. He said that when he first started playing poker, he was sort of looked at as a UCLA computer geek, and not given much respect at all. So he adopted
the
long hair and the black cowboy hat and the sunglasses and all the other.
You know, earlier in one of our earlier podcasts, you certainly talked about, you know, building your image to be like more so a magnified version of yourself. So, you know, I guess that is an example, right, of how to build an image so that you sort of have a persona at the table.
He did it. He built a persona, and, you know, for Chris, it works perfectly.
Oh, very well.
Somebody else, not going to work at all.
Oh, yeah. Who's that guy, Mike the Mouse? All he does is talk. I love him, though.
Mike Mattisow.
Yes, and I have seen him be a complete gentleman in many situations. So he might have a mouth, but I've also seen him. He can take it, too. He can take it.
You know, he and Phil Hellmuth are just the poker
bad boys.
Yeah, the dysfunctional children of poker.
Poker bad boys, but they're fun. I mean, why not? I mean, tennis had the other guy who always acted out, right? We remember tennis.
Yeah, look, yeah, every
you remember tennis like it's over. No, they do still play.
Every sport has them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's you need a John McEnroe and a Jimmy
Connors.
Oh,
John McEnroe, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. So it's fun to see poker develop and see the players come out and build their personas and become sort of the type of, a different type, fall into different categories. So I know we're all enjoying it, you know, and the younger players coming out, it's like they don't have any rules, which I think is great, too. Watching the new online, you know, college kids coming on, they're doing very well in the tournaments. They seem to know no limits to their play, literally, no limits, and they seem to can do anything. They seem to be able to do anything at any time.
They do, and I think they have a big edge in the sense that, you know, with the fields as large as they are these days, and tournaments being multi-day affairs.
Right.
I think from a stamina viewpoint, it really helps to be
young and in fit. Yeah. In fact, I was just saying that, you know, should I ever decide to play in the World Series of Poker, I have to train for this. You've got to train physically, mentally. You've got to be able to put in long hours, long days, not lose your edge, not get tired. These are all factors that are going to come into play with these many, many day tournaments. You know, I don't know how many they're expecting this year at the World Series of Poker, but it's going to be over what, 7,000-8,000 probably?
Maybe not that many, but regardless, it's going to be a long, grueling.
Grueling is the word, yeah. So meanwhile, though, to make it less grueling on us, I'd like you to talk a little bit about stealing the blinds, because you may be a great player and be able to get to a certain stage of this tournament, but once the blinds are big enough to matter, right, blind stealing becomes a critical strategic play, and knowledge of when to steal the blinds. What is the ideal blind stealing opportunity? What is the presentation of the table like to know that this is your opportunity? So I think when you learn that skill set of stealing the blinds, you can really keep your play going until you can hit a very good hand, you know, that continues to move you upwards in ranking in the tournament or in standing in the tournament. So blind stealing, just the word stealing. You know, I want to say one thing first, Lou, is that just the word stealing makes you think, oh, this is really bad, I shouldn't do it. Let's ditch the word stealing. It's more like, you know, taking an opportunity. Tell us a little bit about it.
It isn't a bad thing. I mean,
no.
You know, it's here's the motto for looking at blinds. If the shoe fits, steal it.
That's the best.
Now, there comes a time in every tournament when you have antes added to the blinds. Now, when antes are added to the blinds, then there's a large chunk of dead money every hand, and you need to steal blinds to keep, if for no other reason than you want to keep up with your opponents.
That's right.
Or also stealing blinds. If you don't steal blinds at all,
mm-hmm.
First of all, they're going to know when you have a good hand in the blind and when you don't, and
mm-hmm.
your opponents will act accordingly, and that means you'll win less money on your good hands because they'll get out of your way.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to steal in self-defense. You also have to steal because of the opportunity cost of all that dead money.
Absolutely right. And, you know, I wanted to ask you about an ideal blind stealing, because there may be a time when it's not right. I don't know if you get a feeling or a sense of the table. Everyone's folded to the big blind, to the dealer. The dealer decides, okay, I'm going to steal the blind, or the cutoff sheet decides I'm going to steal the blind. You know, is there an art to stealing the blinds?
Of course there is. First of all, when you steal from the button or the cutoff seat, it looks like a steal. So there's a chance that if your opponent has a marginally decent but not great hand, and it goes fold, fold, fold all the way around to the button or the cutoff seat, and he fires a raise in, if your opponent thinks you're stealing, he will re-steal it from you by re-raising you. Now, if you have no hand, you've got no choice but to throw it away.
Right, exactly.
Everyone, of course, is looking, again, for a formula. What's the perfect position that I can calculate? I have a guaranteed blind steal. Well, you know, if you have an image as a tight player, if you haven't stolen a blind since Jimmy Carter was in the house,
you could probably get away with it.
You're the little old lady that looks like the woman that used to be on the Where's the Beef commercial.
Oh, yes, that's right. You could probably get away with it.
All those people could steal one blind anytime, get away with it 100%. It depends on what image you're representing to the table and what you perceive of as your opponent's way of playing. If you're playing against people that are cautious, that tend to play a card-dependent strategy, if they're basing their playing strategy on and only on the cards they have in front of them, then you have a pretty good chance of stealing the blinds, because most of the time the blinds are going to have junk. Mm-hmm. But if they're creative players who can play back at you by re-raising, even if they don't have a good hand, you have to be a bit more careful about when you steal a blind. But the fact remains, you really, really do have to try to steal. Now, if you're in late position and nobody has entered the pot yet, lots of hands that wouldn't have looked very good in early position look awfully good when you're trying to steal a blind.
Mm-hmm.
Any pair at that point becomes a real good hand.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have a pair of deuces, even if your opponent has ace-king,
mm-hmm.
you are a favorite against heads-up against an ace-king with a pair of deuces. Mm-hmm. So if you have a pair of sevens, you must raise. If you have ace-king or ace-queen, you must raise. On the other hand, the kinds of hands that are very positionally dependent, that can't be played unless there are a lot of players in the hand, are not so good for stealing the blind.
Right.
For instance, you know, you've got 7-6 suited. Well, if you're called and you miss the flop, you're sitting there with a 7 high, and it's hard for you to go much further in that hand if your opponent is aggressive towards you at all.
Right. Absolutely. Do you ever want to entice? Now, we're talking about later stages of a tournament where the antes are high and the blinds are high. Let's say you want to steal. What are you suggesting? How many times the big blind, you know, signals a steal, and unless somebody has a good hand, they don't want to bother with you? Are you saying 3 times still?
Yeah, 3 or 4 times. It depends on what seems to be your normal raise and the
mm-hmm.
table's normal raise. It's usually 3 to 4 times the
what
big blind.
Sure.
And I wouldn't make it any different. I mean, look, I'm not going to raise with a pair of aces any differently than I raise with a steel hand, because if I do that, if I bet proportionally to the strength of my hand, it's not going to take very much time at all for somebody to mentally have a little chart that says, oh, he made it 5 times the big blind, therefore
right,
he's got
exactly.
a fair hand.
And when you have a good hand, it's only 2 times. But question for you, do you ever want to play a hand? Let's say you don't want it to look like a steal because you want to entice somebody to come into the pot with you, because you're thinking, I'm thinking I'm going to do very well on this hand. I don't want to just lose, you know, steal the blinds. I want to play. I want to play poker. Do you have a suggestion for how to entice maybe one or two of the... you definitely want only one, probably the big blind, to stay in, but in terms of raising amounts, would you vary?
I'm going to give that to you as a question. Suppose I've been stealing the blind with some normal regularity, whatever that is, and I've been doing it by making a bet of 4 times...
I get your question. I would fold because I knew you were trapping me.
Right? Why, exactly. And then and all of a sudden, I'm on the button and I just say call. Well, what do you think I have?
I know. I'd head out that door faster than you can even see me.
I either have 7-6 suited, or I have a pair of aces, and you know, it's just a signal for someone to stop and sit up
and take notice,
because your opponent is very differently right then and there than he has the entire couple of hours you've been playing with.
Now, would you say at that stage of the tournament, mixing up your play in the steal position, okay, the button, the cutoff position, it would be appropriate, or would it ever be appropriate?
It's always appropriate. I think that if let's say I'm in the cutoff and it's checked all the way around to me and I'm looking at a four deuce and I throw it away, the very fact that I threw away that rotten, horrid hand lends credence to the hand I raise with the next time, even if that's a four deuce.
Right, right. Yeah, because you can't be doing it every single time, right?
You can't do everything at the extremes. You can't be at the extremes all the time because you're very readable then. So you have to vary your play and not give them any clue at all about what you have.
That's right. That's right. I my rule of thumb is the third time is the kiss of death. So you make it away the first, for one time, two times, the same play. But then the third time, I don't know, some people say, hey, you can't do that to me. I'm playing back at you.
Okay, yeah, and you know, look, since you're going to vary your play, vary it by throwing away your horrible hands to lend some credence to the time.
Sure. And then when you really do have to raise with a 4-2 unsuited or whatever, you know, you have a shot at making it happen.
You have a shot at it. So what do you raise with? But, you know, at that point, any pair looks good.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody's entered the pot yet, any ace figures to be a good hand.
Sure.
Figures to be better than the random hand that your opponents have, because if I have an ace, there are only three left in the deck, and the chances are that one of the blinds has an ace is small. Even any king is a fairly decent hand to raise with if you've got people that are willing to throw their hands away on the button or in earlier position in the blinds.
Okay, let me ask you a question about how to defensively play your hand if you are the small blind and the person to your right, okay, on the button, right at this point, has a big stack, and your stack is not that big. Let's say it's moderate, and you're trying, you know, you're at this point, you're at the point where you want to play, you want to make some money, you got to get back in the game, right? So you're not really at risk, but you're still, you know, you still can compete. But you've got this big stack, right? And we all know about the big stack bullying tactics, which we'll learn about too, believe me. You know, keep sort of raising it, you know, ridiculously high. Certain point, how do you stop this, you know, this bully, this button bully from coming after you every time?
Yeah, well, first of all, I just hate the expression defending your blind, although I use it too. I don't think you want to think in terms of defending your blind so much as you want to think in terms of how can I get what I want to, what I want to achieve from my opponent and from his large stack of chips.
Sure. How to optimize the hand that you do have against the strategy, or keep in mind the strategy that this person is playing against you. I agree
now,
with you. Yes.
If you were a Japanese judo master, you would think, I will let him, your inclination as a judo expert would be, I will let him keep pushing back at me until he leans so far over that his own weight is going to carry
tumble him
tumble him down, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're doing is, go ahead, steal my blind, I will let you, but when I have a big hand and you make a raise, then I'm going in for all my chips.
Right.
And I'm going to try to double through.
That's right. That's good. I appreciate you sharing that.
I think the mental picture of digging your heels in and saying, you know, like Davy Crockett at the Alamo, we got a line in the sand, and we're defending right here. I mean,
Well, you know what
those
was
guys
funny?
Actually didn't fare too well.
No, and in my early play, right, I took it as a personal insult. Now, here's where you have to work on yourself in poker, Lou, as you know, is that sometimes your poker play does reflect your personal characteristics, your tendencies, right? So when they would try to steal my blinds, I would think, you can't do that to me. I want to stand up for myself. And then I realized, hey, I got to chill, because I kept a record of the hands I won and how that hurt me when I tried to, you know, just call because I didn't want anybody doing that to me, that kind of thing. I had to realize, hey, this is we have to look at this a little differently. So in real life, no, I don't like anyone to take advantage of me. Yeah, I don't like that at all. So when I sort of applied that same thinking, right, to somebody stealing my blinds, I realized this is not going to help me at all. This doesn't belong in the game. So I had to actually work through the issue and say, this is not my job to go after and defend my blinds and possibly get blown out of the tournament. You know, it's my job to play each hand responsibly given the cards I'm getting in the situation. So I was able to get rid of that bad habit very soon. And you know how I did it? Funny part about it is after each game I played, I would write down my personal defects that affected my play. So I started to build this list, right? And I would know, and then when I play the next game, I'd look over the list and I'd say, okay, I have a tendency to have a personal reaction against somebody stealing my blinds. So I had to work on eliminating that from my game. Now I could care less. You want my blind and I have nothing, take it. I don't care, because sooner or later I'm going to get yours or others.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting point that you bring up, too, because if you're playing a cash game and somebody keeps raising your blind and stealing it and raising your blind and stealing it, eventually you're going to slap back at them by re-raising. Now, you may have picked the very time that he has a pocket pair of aces.
Right, of course.
A chunk of money. But if you're in a cash game, you reach into your wallet and pull out some money.
That's
the danger
funny.
Of making that play in a tournament is that you are out of the tournament.
Especially a big tournament, you know, one like the World Series of Poker, the one that you've paid the big bucks to get into. You know, so you've got to be careful, right?
Well, you don't, when you're in, when you're in a tournament, you don't want to take risks for all your chips unless you figure you got the best of it and weigh the best of it. Now, when you play back at somebody, just stop him from raising or you out of the blinds on future hands, you may never even have that chance come up again. They may break the table.
Sure.
Anything may happen. And again, if you lose all your chips, you know, in a cash game, you're betting money.
Mm-hmm.
In a tournament, you're when you put chips in the pot, you're really committing a portion of your equity in the tournament as a bet. So it's not money so much as it's a percentage of all you own.
That's a very good way to look at that.
When you have more to lose, you have to be a little bit cautious.
Mm-hmm. And maybe look to other strategy, which is why we're doing our podcast, so that you can learn not a tool, sure, stealing blinds, whatever. But you know what, if it's not working for you, if things are coming up that you didn't expect, if you've got this tough big stack doing things, you know, pushing you around a little bit, you know, you have to have other tools in your arsenal so you can avoid going up against this particular situation over and over again, and use some of the other tools that Lou mentioned today in this interview and some of the other ones. Right, Lou? Have a variety of strategies you can employ.
Well, there are a variety of strategies, and in a tournament you have to survive at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
Give you an analogy from the real world. Suppose I said to you, I'll give you 4-1 if you can cross this street and avoid being hit by a snowball that these 3 10-year-old boys are throwing at you. You know, cross the street, you don't get hit, you get $100. If you do get hit, you give me $25.
Mm.
Well, that's a pretty good risk. You're getting 4-1 on, let's say it's even money. But if I said I'll give you the same bet, but now instead of avoiding the snowballs, you've got to cross the San Diego freeway
or the railroad track
in the afternoon.
Wow.
And, if you get through, you get through. But if you get hit, you die. At that point, being a 4-1 favorite doesn't look so good.
You know,
because the potential of risk is so much greater.
See,
and it's like that in tournament poker.
That is the most brilliant thing, because you read a lot of books and they're all talking about the odds. And 4-1, yeah, you go for it. Well, and I'm always thinking, well, wait a minute, though. You know, you could blow out your whole tournament. This is the whole point. So maybe it doesn't look so good. And I love the way you just said that, because it's probably something the early and developing player really needs to understand. The risk of being blown out of the tournament is many times not worth it, no matter what the odds are, right?
Well, yeah, the other thing is that you can be so short-staffed as a result of the bad play.
Yeah.
If you do get a good hand later on, you can't make any money with it.
That's right, and that should probably be some of the other podcast topics that we come back to is, you know, how to play on tilt, let's say, or how to play after a bad beat and how to recover and some tournament strategy. I know that these are things you'd love to share with us. Is there anything, Lou, that we didn't cover today that you feel would be, that you really want to share with our listeners?
No, I just want to say that I've had a great time doing this.
Wonderful.
I would love your listeners to visit my website, check out my books.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to learn something depending on what your state of development is as a poker player.
Right, something for everyone.
And if you get one good idea out of a poker book, it'll pay for the cost of the book many, many times over.
Right. And the best way to learn poker, I mean, what I found, is you take it easy, you relax, you chill, and every time you do go back to study, after playing a game, you pick up something new. It just happens that way, so that you play a lot, and you go back to the books. You play a lot, you go back to the books. Pretty soon, it all starts making sense. You know,
yeah,
so initially what seems like, oh my God. You know, it's funny, I was telling somebody the other day, initially it seems so easy. And then when you start to realize what you're doing, it seems so hard and complicated. And then at the very end, when you finally know what you're doing, it's easy again.
Yeah, you've nailed it. It's an iterative, recursive cycle of learning, playing, thinking about the game.
Right.
Learning, playing, thinking about the game, and it just sort of spirals upward. And
sure.
You can't ever stop learning, because if you stop, someone else out there is continuing to learn, and he or she is going to pass you while you're standing still.
Well, that's a great point to make, and I'm so happy that you're able to join us today and on our previous podcast. Lou Krieger is my guest and has been my guest on the last three podcasts. Encourage everyone to stay with our Podcasting Pro series. We have lots of wonderful guests coming. Of course, we have Lou coming back to visit us again with another series of podcasts. Meanwhile, though, please do visit his website, www.loukrieger.com, and you can buy any of his 11 books. They're all fabulous. I bought them all, actually. In case I didn't tell you that earlier, I did buy them all. And actually, the blog might be a very good idea to get on Lou's blog and see what you can learn there as well. And the address for the blog is http://Lou Krieger.blogspot.com. That's loukrieger.blogspot.com. Lou, thanks so much for being an amazing guest. You were fantastic.
Thank you, Annie. I loved it. I'm looking forward to coming back. I'm eager to do more.
Terrific. Well, we want you back, and we'll have you back soon. Thanks again.
Thanks.
All for now, guys.